The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. My name is Susan Gould, and I am a proud member of the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation staff, and I'm happy to welcome all of you here tonight. It's my pleasure to introduce restaurateur, TV personality, and best-selling cookbook author, Lydia Bastianich. She will be in conversation this evening with Elizabeth Fitzgerald, who's the director of the Free Library's Culinary Literacy Center. For almost 50 years, Lydia, and I hope she won't be insulted by my referring to her by her first name, but she has made us all feel like we're a part of her family. Lydia has shared her passion for food and family with limitless enthusiasm. She opened her first restaurant in New York in 1971, and today runs four popular restaurants there, as well as two more with her daughter Tanya in Pittsburgh and Kansas City. Her numerous public television series and cookbooks, notably the Emmy-winning Lydia's Kitchen, and the much-praised Mastering the Art of Italian Cuisine, have brought the warmth and joy of Italian cooking to homes around the world. And in 2010, with her son Joe, she introduced Eataly, the popular Italian food emporium, to the United States, where it now has six locations, maybe seven, I'm not sure. She's won countless accolades for her restaurants, books, television programs, and humanitarian work, including seven James Beard Awards and a special achievement award from the National Italian American Foundation. Born in an Italian province that soon after became part of Yugoslavia, Bastianich and her family fled a communist regime when she was 8 years old, landing in a refugee camp in Trieste, Italy. It was during this time in the kitchen of a Catholic convent and school outside the camp walls that she first cooked for a crowd. In her new book, My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food, she tells the incredible and timely story of this journey from behind the Iron Curtain to waiting tables as a teenager in New York to becoming one of the culinary world's most dynamic and beloved figures. The Washington Post has called it compelling, poignant, and a quintessential immigrant story. I know we are all eager to hear what these ladies have cooked up for us this evening, so let me just say, in the words of our author, tutti a tavola a mangiare, with Lydia Bastianich and Liz Fitzgerald at the Free Library. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming them.
Thank you, Susan. Hello, everyone. And hello, Lydia.
Buonasera. Buonasera a tutti.
Buonasera. Lydia.
Yes.
I loved your book.
Thank you.
It was a wonderful read.
Thank you.
And one of my favorite parts was hearing about the time that you spent with your grandparents at their home in the country. Can you talk a little bit about that and what impact that had on your life?
Sure. I think it is the basis of me, who I am, and my passion and love with food. But maybe, Liz, I need to tell a little bit about the history so they know why.
Please.
So I was born in what is now Istria, and it's now part of Croatia. That whole part, Istria and Little Dalmatia, was Italy. But after World War II, Italy lost the war. And in 1947, ultimately, it was given to the newly formed communist Yugoslavia. Now, the war ended in 44, but, you know, the Allied forces stayed around there for 2-3 years, deciding where, ultimately, the border is going to go. And it was the Paris Treaty in 1947 that ultimately delineated the border. And I was just born in 1947. So that area, it's a border kind of area. It always was. It was under the Austrian-Hungarians. So there was people coming from the east of Europe. And so it was kind of a mixed area always. But we were Italian in Istria. We were ethnic Italians with the other, coexisted with the other ethnicities. And at that time, 350,000 actually Italians from Istria migrated back into Italy and on. So it was a big exodus. But my mother was expecting me. Where was she going to go? And they decided that maybe they'll stay there at least until I was born. And so in 1947, February 21st, I was born. I think the Paris Treaty was February 26th or whatever, 47. So I just got. But communists did set in. The border went up. It was a tough border, patrolled with barbed wire, dogs, and all of that. And the communist Marshal Tito was the president or the leader, and he really began to pressure the communist dogma on the people, changing our name. We couldn't speak Italian. We couldn't go to church. So there were many limitations. My mother was elementary school teacher. My father was a mechanic, and living in the city, my father mechanic, but he had two little trucks, and so ultimately they took the trucks away. He was deemed a capitalist. He was incarcerated for about 6 months because of that. What my parents decided was that maybe the best, I have a brother who's 3 years older than I am, that the best for us would be to put us with grandma. And grandma was in a little town about four miles away from the city center of Pula. That's the city I was born. And the little town was called Busoler. And food was also beginning to be scarce. So grandma, with her animals, provided the food for the whole family, not just my family, but my aunt's family, and so on. And what she had in this little sort of complex, if you will, very small, we had chickens, we had ducks, we had geese, we had rabbits, we had goats. In the morning, I would milk the goats, and that was breakfast, goat's milk for breakfast. We had two pigs, and in November, I remember, was the slaughter. We made the prosciutto, the sausages, and I was kind of a little helper and a little runner for grandma, so was my brother. She also had an extension of the garden, you know, so everything seasonal, peas, favas, now in the spring. Actually, I'm going to go in a few weeks. Before even the garden gave us food to eat, we would go forage because, you know, foraging the wild asparagus began, the dandelion. So I would go with grandma and help her out, you know, with the little baskets, collect the figs, even the potatoes. You know, she would plant the potatoes and, you know, I would go after her. She would take the big ones, you know, the potatoes, the tuber, so she would collect the big ones. I would make sure that no little ones were left in the ground. But you know what was wonderful, and I still feel it, that those potatoes were warm in my hands. Yeah. They felt like they were alive. I can still remember that. And, you know, big rosemary bushes. We used to play hide and seek in the rosemary bushes. We used to insert ourselves in there. You came out, and I smelled like rosemary for 3 days. Yeah. I mean, I didn't need deodorant or anything. Yeah. So, you know, all of those aromas and flavors. We had some olive trees. Grandpa, November was olive oil time. We would help to gather the olives. And so I grew up in that setting, you know, where everything, grandma would make the bread. And I was always around helping grandma whatever she needed. But inevitably, you know, I absorb all of that, all of those flavors, those aromas. And, you know, I know that my reference library till this day of flavors is back into those flavors. You know, I'm with those flavors. And whenever I cook, those flavors somehow come back to my mind, and I want to get to those flavors.
Yeah.
Not always do I get there.
And the scene where you describe the pig slaughter is really vivid.
You know, the whole book, because I'm not... the memoirs was something different for me. Certainly, I'm not a memoir writer, and I had my daughter help me, whatever. But along the way, I knew that, you know, I wanted to say for my children and grandchildren what I remembered. Mm-hmm. And I remember this slaughter so vividly that I just sat down one day, and it took me about 2 days to write it details by detail, and then I had it ready. So when the memoirs came, oh, I'm going to have to share this. So were you impressed by that?
It was great. I have never before craved polenta with blood in it, but it was, I was like, oh, I want to
try
that.
The blood sausages, you know, yes. when they first, the slaughter of the pigs, it's a whole ritual. So it's in November because, of course, temperature, they didn't have a refrigerator. And it was chilly. November begins to be cold going into the winter. And there were a set of two macellai, the slaughterers, the butchers, if you will, mm-hmm. that went through the towns. And you would sort of book our house and then 2 days after the next house. And, right. you know, we all helped each other. But what would happen was that they took this men. My grandfather put two barrels, wine barrels, empty mm-hmm. old wine barrels, and across it a plank of wood, an old door or whatever. And the men would catch the pigs and with their legs. And I remember squealing. Us kids used to run away, and it would actually really puncture right into the heart. So once that with a sharp long knife, I recall. Once that was, they would sort of bend the pig on a side, and grandma was there with a bucket to collect all of the blood because you didn't waste anything. We made the blood sausages right away because the blood, those were the most perishable, the right. organs, the inner organs, the liver and all of that, those are the ones that you ate first. And so she would catch the blood, and the first thing right after they were still working on cutting the pig down, the blood would be in a big pan, and she would put in it with a big wooden spoon, and I would help. Mm-hmm. She would put in it polenta flowers and raisins and sometimes a little chocolate and cinnamon, and this would densen up and cook. And then by that time, some of the innards, mm-hmm. the intestines were cleaned and all of that, and the blood was stuffed in those intestines right. and tied, and that was the blood sausage. And she would keep it, since they didn't have a refrigerator.
Right.
She would keep it. She would all this the fatty pieces of the pig. She would render it, mm-hmm. and it would become a strutto, if you will, or lard. And she would insert, once the lard solidified, after you sort of melted down the lard into a liquid, mm-hmm. then it solidifies, and in there she would put the blood sausages, she would put the regular sausages, because they were protected in there, and they would keep for a longer time.
Wow, it's fascinating. And now we go to the grocery store and just pick up.
You see what you're missing?
Yes, well, what do you think we are missing, being so far
well,
removed?
Well, I think, and one of the reasons also that, you know, I love to share, whether it's on television, whether it's writing my books, whether it's talking, and especially with my grandchildren and family, mm-hmm. that these traditions, these real traditions, you know, we need to know. I think that kids today, a lot of them don't know where food comes from. You know, it's a plastic package that the chicken comes from, and they have no sensibility because, right. you know, they don't know that that chicken needs to be fed. It's part of our environment, and it affects our existence as a whole, as a world. So if you understand how animals grow and how animals need to be fed and how they, in turn, feed us,
yes.
you know, they keep us alive. They give us the gift of continued life. Then you begin to respect more, maybe, in not wasting, watching your environment more. You know, the chicken doesn't only have breasts in plastic. It has feet, it has a head, it has... Grandma used to use everything. You want to hear the story?
Please.
Okay. So the chicken, usually that was a Sunday ritual. The chicken or the rabbit, you know, those were kind of smaller protein gifts that we would have on weekends. And usually the chicken, she would go around, she would grab one and, you know, just literally, you know, just twist the neck. And then I would bring the hot water, we would pluck the feathers, and then she would take the chicken, she would put it over the open fire to burn the little sort of hairs that were left. And so the feet, the head, and then she would open it up, the feet, the head, the neck, and all those pieces went into making soup. Mm. The inside, the intestines, the liver, the stomach, which is mm-hmm. a big muscle. We'd open it up, clean it up, cut it thin. And all the, because when you open a chicken, just like a woman, you have the eggs. And the eggs can be as small as a little cranberry and then as big as a regular egg, just ready to come out.
Wow.
And when you open a chicken, you see all of that in there. And, you know, and grandma would collect all of those eggs and make a little bit of onions. And all of the innards, the liver and all of that, that would be a frittata. That would be right away a little snack. And the rest of the chicken, even the intestines, it was my duty. So you took the intestines first, you just cleaned them all out.
Right.
Yeah. Then you took a scissor and you cut them all open and you washed them in vinegar and water. Mm-hmm. And you let them soak in vinegar and water, wash them, rinse them well. And they were cut up and put in a frittata. Now I see Susan Fohi right here. Does that happen in the Chinese culture too? The same thing, huh? Yeah? Okay. Well, you know, the meat, the rest of the meat, then they made a sauce. We made gnocchi or pasta or whatever. Right. So we had soup. We had first a little snack. This is all one chicken. A little snack first. It's marenda with bread, you know. Mm-hmm. We would all dunk in there. She would put some scallions, whatever. Then we would have soup, and then we would have usually gnocchi and the sauce from the chicken. And that was a Sunday meal. That was a festive Sunday meal with the chicken.
Well, I'm coming over next Sunday, then, please. Okay. And do you cook like this with your grandchildren? I mean, one of the themes in this book I noticed is grandmothers and their connection with their grandchildren.
I always say, you know, my mother, who's 98, and you know how she lives with me. So, you know, we are four generations in my house at any given time, especially the weekends or whatever. Now, they all have their wife, their lives, their way at colleges. But, you know, from small, absolutely, you know, they would come around. And kids love playing with dough.
Yes.
Yeah, they'll mess everything up. And gnocchi was a good one. You know, and each one would shape. And then when I cooked them, they would look, oh, I made that one. I made that one. And so, yes, and still, they still do. They still, when they come, you know, I tell them, I said, let's set up. Not too long ago, I had two of my youngest grandchildren, mm-hmm. and they made the whole meal. I was right there with them. And I think it's so important because with food comes so much more. It comes, you know, the communication of love, of affection, of culture, of
yes.
who you are, of history,
yes.
of understanding the whole cycle of and relationship of us with the animals, with the vegetables, and so on. It's just food is at the basis. It is the ultimate communicator.
Yes. Another one of my favorite stories from the book is when you and your grandson went to Alaska on the fishing trip.
Yes, yes. Well, I have five grandchildren. And I don't give them gifts. I mean, I used to. But I give them an opportunity, especially when now that they're bigger. And their age is from 16 to 21 now. I give them an opportunity of travel. They whatever they like, you know. And if it's a long trip, then we combine maybe Christmas and birthday or whatever. And they can travel together. They invite each other at their chosen travel. But my grandson, Miles, who is Joseph's middle son, loves fishing. And I love, you know, in my book even I talk, I love seafood, I love the sea. I used to go fishing with my uncle. And so we decided we are going to just him and I on this trip because the other ones weren't so excited about going fishing. And you know, Alaska, I had been to Anchorage once for the public television to do some fundraiser, but I have not been to Alaska. So we went just beyond the Canadian border, and it was a fishing kind of a real fishing. It wasn't a village. I don't know what would they call it. They had huts,
yeah.
and they had real fishermen. And you, because the mountains were in the back, the only way you can get in there was with the boat, or you fly in. And now they have, I think, a weekly flight, but you used to fly with the mail flight, with the mail. You used to come in, but it was beautiful because it was in June, And we had a guide, a fisherman, and the Atlantic, the halibut was running, and the sockeye salmon was running in the rivers. So it was just magnificent. We went out, and we were guided, you know, with somebody, not by ourselves, because of course, but my grandson hooked a 40-pound halibut.
Wow.
And he was, I mean, that's the most exciting. He still talks about it. And, you know, and when they pull it out, you know, the halibut, you know, they shoot it right away because it's so strong that
right.
It could break the fisherman's legs. I didn't know that. And so and then we brought it back to the camp, if you'll say, mm-hmm. and they filleted it for you, and they set it up, and we ate it every night apiece, but the rest... they froze by portion, and of
right.
course we wanted to bring it back. But you know what was beautiful? When they were cleaning all that, the bald eagle, there's so many of them out there.
Yes.
And as soon as, I mean, if you threw this, they would catch it right in midair. So you were so close to nature. We saw the moose. At night, one night, we were in the cabin together. There was a rattling outside, bear. Was
oh
looking
gosh.
In the, so it was extraordinary. We had a great time, and you know, it's memories. It's memories that he will have,
yes,
for the rest of his life. So,
so this whole book, it starts even from before you're born, and extends your whole life. What is it like to write such a comprehensive autobiography?
Well, I had help. Okay. I can't say that I, you know. I said, you know, you start thinking about it, and I couldn't find myself writing about myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I can write about experiences and feelings and all, but I couldn't write about myself. So I had my daughter, and I did have a writer help me. And what they did, her and my daughter, which was, I think, wonderful, they did a skeleton, a kind of a chronological skeleton of my life. And they gave it to me episode by episode. Mm-hmm. And then I would put all the experience and all my emotions. Then I was free. Then I knew where I
right.
was. You know, I didn't have to worry. Yes, even when the were you here, were you there, we did that together. But then the emotions, you know, how did you feel when you did this? You know, and they would ask me. And then I really let loose. So it was. I really enjoyed it because I had help. But I think that I got out what I wanted.
Right. Do you keep journals?
I do keep journals, but not a daily journal, no.
Okay. So one of the defining points in your life, I think it would be fair to say, would be being a refugee. And we have a program in the Culinary Literacy Center called Edible Alphabet, where we've seen hundreds of refugees, and they're learning English through cooking. And they arrive in Philadelphia from the Middle East, from Southeast Asia, from Africa, and they have nothing. Much in the same way that you and your family didn't have much when you left Istria and came to America. But what they bring is they bring recipes, and that's home. And what are the recipes that are home to you?
Well, I think maybe I'll just explain my refugee trip.
Please.
And that is... going back to Istria, communism, in 1956, I was nine or whatever, unbeknownst to my brother and I, my parents decided that they needed to change the situation for us. But as a family, we couldn't get a visa. Now, the border went down. We had family on the Italian side in Trieste, and we were on the other side. And my mother said that our aunt there was very ill, that we had to go and see her. Now, they only gave visas for my brother, myself, and my mother. They didn't give visa to my father. He remained as a hostage because they knew that if the family went together, they would never come back. And so we went, the three of us. My aunt was perfectly fine when I got there, but, you know. So you know, we loved it. We were, you know, as kids in this beautiful city, you know, with lights, with toys, with everything. And, you know, we were having a good time. And then about 2 weeks into the trip, at night, the door knocks, my mother's screaming, my aunt is crying, whatever. My father appeared. So my father literally escaped the border at night. and he was shot at. The scent dogs were chasing him. I specifically remember that when I saw him and whatever, and I asked him after, he gave me an explanation. He was all caked with mud, and he just collapsed. And it was, you know, very tragic, kind of, for us children. It was right. Very emotional. But we later found out that we're not going back, and that we were moving on as children. And I think that my connection to food, only later did kind of I realized that I think this is the reason why I'm so attached to food, and it's kind of maybe going to bring me back to those immigrants that you're talking about, is that I began cooking the food that I remember. The smells, the aromas brought me back to grandma, because I didn't say goodbye to grandma, to my goats, to my friends. Mm. I didn't say goodbye to anybody. And so I felt like I was, you know, pulled out of the ground, out of my setting. And food brought me comfort. Food connected me. And I continued to cook all the food that I remember, that grandma, the smells, the rosemary, the whatever. Till this day, you know, food is my connector. And so I think that those immigrants have the same thing. You know, food makes them feel comfortable. Food makes them feel, because I know how they feel. I came here, I was 12. We didn't speak a word of English. We had nobody here. We were brought here by the Catholic Relief Services. Mm-hmm. Because Trieste, when my father ultimately came, our visas were up. So either if we were caught without our visa expiring, that my father didn't have any, they would have repatriated us. So my father and mother decided they're going to ask for asylum. And we ended up in a political refugee camp in Trieste. For 2 years, we awaited there an opportunity to move on. And it's you know, when we finally, after 2 years, it was in 1958, in the camp. And the camp is a camp, you know, not unlike what's happening today.
Yes.
Online, I had my little plate online for food. So, you know, food has, in my life, has transcended in many different forms. And I think it was all for me, it was positive. It just made me who I am. But in 1958, Dwight Eisenhower was the president. And he opened the immigration for political refugees fleeing communism. And we were one of the first family. And again, we had nobody here in the States. Mm-hmm. The Catholic Relief Services, which did the European settling of refugees, not unlike what's happening today, sort of collaborated with the Catholic services here and the Red Cross. And they brought us here. And they put us initially in a hotel for 3 weeks, then they found a job for my father in New Jersey, I remember. And I remember the job was to install radios in Chevrolet, the new Chevrolet's cars. So that was exciting. But they found a little home for us. And, you know, Liz, I can't help but kind of share the goodness that came out of a lot of people. We had nothing. They found a home. They furnished the whole home for us. People were bringing chairs. People were bringing sheets, towels, food, our cupboards, and all of that. All these people that we didn't know.
Yeah.
And you know, I always think, you know, as a refugee, and you kind of feel you have no home. You don't speak the language. You're lost. And then you see the goodness of the people, and he says, "Well, I'm gonna be fine. They want me here." And it worked out that way, that these people, you know, really helped us, accepted us. And ultimately, we found a way, and we became Americans and grateful, very grateful Americans, because I don't think that this could have happened anyplace else in the world. There's no place like America. Mm-hmm.
And one part that struck me was how you and your brother had to act as translators for your parents. And
yes, you know, as a youngster, first of all, I knew I wanted to be American as soon as possible. I'm going to have a home here, and I'm going to stay here. I'm not going anywhere, you know, as a kid. So you want to learn English as fast, and within the the first year we were ready. And the parents, the adults, take a little longer. Mm-hmm. My mother was okay. My father took much longer. And so the children have to help the parents, you know, whether you need to go to the bank, whether you need to open an account, Con Edison or telephone or whatever. We had to go there with our parents. And I think that's part of also what maybe, you know, because it's Lydia, where did you get this energy and whatever? And I think that's part of it because as a youngster, you learn how to handle situations in life. You learn, you know, the business of it. You need, you know, the savings. You need to watch everything. So I think that, you know, it's a base, you know, there's an old Italian saying that says, tutto il male non viene per nuocere. All the bad things are not always destructive, you know. It's, you know, sometimes you construct on bad experiences. And certainly I think that was our...
And then yours is really such an American story of arriving as an immigrant, and then you became a restaurateur and a chef.
Well, it only really speaks to the fact of what America really is. It's a land of opportunity. It's a land that accepted us. Mm-hmm. It's a land that I felt comfortable and that I feel very much part of. You know, I came here, I was 12. I feel very American, although I retained very much my culture. And I always say I've been super blessed because I have two of the best cultures in the world, the mm-hmm. Italian and the American. There's nothing better out there.
And when you became a restaurateur and a chef, it was at a time when there weren't very many women who were doing that. Mm-hmm. What was that like? Was it lonely? Was it?
You know, it's my food trip was not one of intent. Mm-hmm. I did not plan that I was going to be a chef, that I was going to write cookbooks, all that. Mm-hmm. It was opportunities that came along. So during my schooling here, and I had a whole lot of idea. I liked the sciences. I was, you know, that's where I was going when I was going to school. But the first job I had at 14, I lived in Astoria, and there was right across the street Walken's Bakery. And that's the Christopher Walken family. So I you know, there's three boys. I was 14. I lied. I told them I was 16. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I was always a big girl. And, you know, I wanted if they had a part-time for the weekend, Friday night, Saturday, Sunday. And they took me. And I worked there for, you know, during the weekends for 2-3 years. And then my mother continued. But I worked with the boys. There were three brothers. And with Christopher, we're still friends. So there on the weekends, I would you know, sell and whatever, get packaged. But if somebody needed a cake or something, I would go in the back and I'd write it and I would get excited about doing it. And then when I went down to Hunter in the city, working in restaurants, you know, as a waitress, but whenever there was that last minute, the chef wasn't there, somebody needed a pasta or something, I would go in the kitchen and I would do it. And then I met my husband who was in this industry. He was also an immigrant, but he was in the front of the house, as we say. And we got married, I had a child, and then he wanted to open a restaurant. Now, I wasn't a chef. I cooked with grandma, I cooked at home. Because as a young immigrant, my mother worked late and I prepared dinner. She would direct me and I would prepare dinner. And the one thing in the bakery that did me well was what I loved when I was shopping is the Heinz package mix for cake. I loved that. We had a cake every night for dinner. Because all you had to add was an egg or something, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I kind of felt very successful in
this.
But, and so food kind of, you know, all goes back, I guess, to my connectiveness with food and whatever. And then when, in 1971, we finally opened our first little restaurant, and we hired a chef, and that was in Forest Hills in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. And it was 9 tables. That's always a very small restaurant. We hired a chef, and then I realized, I said, you know, Lydia, you got to learn this craft. And so I became his sous chef. And for 9 years, I worked with him as a sous chef. He was an Italian-American chef. And at home, we cook differently. We cook the regional Italian food. Mm-hmm. And after 10 years, we had two restaurants, we sold them, and ultimately decided that we would open in New York. And that was Philidia. And I was going to become the chef. We had a little economical difficulties in opening it. You know, over budget, like things go.
Right.
We never planned on the building needing an underpinning. So $200,000 over budget at that time. We almost didn't make it. But we opened, and I became the chef. And I began cooking regional Italian food. Mm-hmm. The food of the 20 regions of Italy. Now, through the years, I went back to Italy, and because I didn't know all the regions. I knew how much I needed to know. But, you know, I knew what Italian food, regional Italian food. And that's how I began kind of to be noticed as a chef. Cooking, you know, like polentas and risottos and mm-hmm. gnocchi and all these kind of different ethnical. And that's when Julia Child, James Beard,
right.
and all the journalists were intrigued in what this woman was doing. But to get back to the question of women, absolutely, you know, I was in a family setting, so I wasn't as, you know, but when I went out and I got into the chef community mm-hmm. and did events or collaborated, certainly there were no women chefs.
Right.
Most of them were, you know, hot chefs with their big hat. I never wore a hat. I said, you know, the toque. So you begin to realize the difficulties of women in our industry. And I think just now it's beginning to clear. It's a difficult profession. It's a difficult profession. The hours,
right.
the intensity of the work, and the environment. You know, the male chefs dominated. There's mm-hmm. no question about it.
And then the show. We need to talk about the shows.
Okay.
I love your shows. I feel like I grew up on you. What was it like turning your home kitchen into a studio?
Well, that happened. And as I say, you know, most of my life and career were opportunities which I chose and worked at it. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't come to me. You know, that's one thing, young people come, I said, you have to have a passion, you have to be committed, and let me tell you, you have to work. That's when you become successful. And so when I opened Philidia, I told you Julia Child came one night and James Beard, she wanted to know the risotto, mushroom risotto, I remember. She loved it. She wanted to learn how to cook it. She came over the house. I taught her how to cook it. Ultimately, she invited me on her show. We remained friends. Mm-hmm. I did two episodes of her Master Chef series. And, you know, I was very comfortable. It was comfortable with her. And the producer says, Lydia, you're pretty good. How about a show of your own? And so she really encouraged me, I must say.
Yeah.
She really encouraged me. She says, Lydia, you do for Italian food what I did for French food. But I must say that, you know, I think that I hope that my mannerism on television is something that I learned from her, and that is how important the viewer is and mm-hmm. and communicating, teaching the viewer, rather than showing the viewer how much you know. How can I pull the viewer into making this food, which is, I can make delicious food, doesn't have to be complicated. That's what Italian cuisine is all about. And with that, they bring Lydia into their house.
Yes.
And so we did, decided with the producer, said, okay, but I had two requests. One of them, I wanted to be on PBS, like Julia, because I think, you know, till this day, actually it was 20 years past that I'm on PBS.
Wow.
And it's a platform that I appreciate, respect, and that's where I want to be. And the second that I ask is that we film in our house.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the last 5 years, I no longer film in my house because my mother, 98, but that brought me comfort. I says, in the studio, what am I going to do in the studio? I don't know studio. But my house, my kitchen, I knew. So if you can bring the cameras in my kitchen, I can cook. And so we did for 15 years.
It's amazing, your show. And, you know, the way that you cook, it really is so approachable. And you inspire the viewer to know that they, too, can make this meal.
But people, you know, I don't know, there's the whole period of the after war and the Industrial Revolution and women going out to work rather than to be home and food being delegated to big industry to feed us. And that's where it all went kind of wrong. But everybody can, you know, everybody can connect to food. You know, we all eat. So on some level, everybody can do something with a little instruction.
Yes.
People can cook. And I, you know, I always, when I say, oh, I can't cook. I said, yes, you can. You know, it's simple. And cooking is simple. The secret is the ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have good, fresh ingredients. And then, you know, it's very little that you can do to ruin it. You know, if you have some... No? Be simple. Don't try to recreate the product. Just exalt it. A little garlic, a little oil, a little peperoncino. Just look at Lydia.
So, Lydia, before I turn it over to the audience for questions, I have a very important question to ask you. At the PBS Christmas party, can you please confirm that it is you, Rick Steves, Maggie Smith, Mary Berry, Jacques Pepin? Can you please tell me that you are all there celebrating together? And who hits the eggnog a little too hard? Who's the best dancer?
Oh, I love to dance. We do get together, not all the time at all.
Really?
Well, we do. Was Jacques Pepin's birthday, which we actually all flew out to San Francisco to cook for him, and then I think it was taped. I think it was even shown on. So, you know, to get us all together like that, it takes, you know, either PBS or a big event or something. And we show up, absolutely, because we appreciate the platform that we have.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. All right, well, thank you so much. This has been just truly a dream. Being here with you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I am sure that there are some questions in the audience. And just before you ask your questions, please wait for the microphone so that they can be captured for the recording.
Thanks, Lydia, for all you do. Do you ever get back to see your grandma?
You know, I forgot to tell you. After 10 years, I did go back. And she did see me. I went back actually with my husband, and then I did bring back both of my children to see her. So yeah, we did go back, and I go back to that courtyard every year. The courtyard is a little desolate now. You know, there's where the pens where the animals are empty. There's nobody, and I have my cousins around the bend. Find peace there. And I go foraging. I'm going to go in April. I go foraging for asparagus, all that. It just kind of brings back, you know, those basic values in life.
Lydia, I have a recipe that I cut out of a magazine. Uh-huh. It was 9 years ago. It's Gramigna pasta. Gramigna is my maiden name. I sent this to all my siblings, and there are a lot of them. Where did that come from?
Is that my recipe?
It's your recipe.
Can you spell?
Gramigna.
Gramigna. Gramigna. Yeah, Gramigna.
Gramigna, but we were dumb. We called it Gramigna.
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 Gramigna is a curly pasta. It's unusual. You know, there's, I don't know, it must be at least a few hundred different shapes of pasta, and they keep on coming with new ones. But gramigna is one of the old pasta, and now it's a dry pasta. So did you make that recipe?
Oh, no. Oh. I married an Irishman, and they don't know how to cook.
So,
But I just wondered where the gramigna came from. If it was
gramigna, from. You know, dry pasta. So Italy is split by its fats, oil on the south, butter on the north. And so it is by its pasta. Dry pasta is basically south, Rome and south, even, and fresh pasta is north. So it could be anywhere from Abruzzo on down in. But it's, I think, around the Abruzzo area. In the gramigna, I think, comes from that area.
Hi, Lydia. I'm so glad to finally meet you because we watch you. My mother and I, my mother's 101, we watch you every Saturday on the PBS channel. I don't have a question, but I just want to tell you, I did make your homemade marinara sauce along with ravioli that you did the leeks and the onions and et cetera, and my brother-in-law just loved them and couldn't stop eating. I didn't know how to get the dough to go wide, and so happened you happened to be doing that on your show at that particular time. So I learned that particular trait. So thank you very much.
Good. Keep on cooking.
Hello, Lydia. How are you?
Okay.
Does Philadelphia have any hope of having one of your restaurants?
You know, I think Philly is a great city, and I think you have a lot of great restaurants here, you know, my dear friend Vetri, Mark Vetri, and so on. But so, you know, I think after all these years in the business, my children, it's up to them where they go. But but we have been looking as Italy at Philly. Mm. And so it's all a question of time. It's all a question of time and finding the real estate.
Hi, Lydia.
Hi.
How long does it normally take you to film one of your seasons?
Okay, a show that lasts 28 minutes takes 3 hours to film. And that's 3 hours just the cooking part. Mm. And then what we call B-roll, when you see me prancing around Italy or someplace else, that's all in addition. So in a day's work where I have we're up in Connecticut, We are in a kitchen showroom, and with a crew to film the cooking show. We have a crew of about 30. Mm-hmm. We have 5 cameras, and usually you do 2 episodes a day. If you're lucky, I'll get 2.5. So, and I do 2 to 3 recipes an episode. So it's you know, it's intense labor. You have to do it right, the lighting, it's just never ending, and the cooking, and then the photography and all of that. It, you know, and then of course we edit it all down, so in 28 minutes you see what you see. But yeah, it takes it's not an easy process.
As a first generation, my mother came here, and her first American food was a hot dog, as she said.
What?
A hot dog. That was the first American food that she ate when she came to America. What was your first American food?
Okay, so 12 years old, we were put in a hotel on 36th Street between 6th and 5th Avenue because the social workers, the charities were right around there. And couldn't cook in a hotel, and of course we didn't eat in the hotel restaurant, but there was a Horn and Hardart right across. And I must say that, you know, the charity, we went to the social worker, and they would give us money to eat, you know, so much each week, and they told us, here's Horn and Hardart, there's a little Italian deli. But I remember specifically Horn and Hardart because I was taking, you know, those little windows. You put a nickel in, and you open up, and the food came out, these pies, the whatever, you know. That was pure magic. After having to kill, after having to kill the chicken, you know, you get this, oh, that was magic. But some of the first foods that I remember, Jell-O, I had never had this wobbly red stuff, you know. I mean, I didn't know what that was. That was one, grapefruit we didn't have. Those I remember, and then slowly everything else came. But I know that in Horn and Hardart, they had the whole thing, you can help yourself, and chicken and potatoes. Because initially, I have to tell you, initially my mother was afraid to spend the money. She said, you know, I'm going to have to return this money. So for the first week, all we ate was Wonder Bread, bananas, and milk. Mom taught bananas very nourishing. You get all the vitamins and minerals. Milk is good and bread is good. And so when we came back to the social worker the next day, and the social worker wanted to give her for the next week, and she pulled out the money. She says, no, I have money. I don't need your money. And the social worker says, no, you got to feed these kids. Now, they spoke Italian. You got to feed these kids. You got to give meat. Because, yes, what did they eat? And so, you know, it was a process of learning and whatever. Do you know that? After a year thereafter, we were settled, and my parents began to work and whatever. And we went back for a year checkup, I guess, with the social worker. And my mother had kept file a record of how much they gave her, and she had saved it. And when we went back on the first year, she brought the money, and she wanted to give it back. And the woman said, no, we want you to be good Americans. You use this for your children.
Hi, Lydia.
Hi.
I've spent a lot of time with you recently, and I got to thank you for all you do.
Oh, thank you for inviting me in your house.
It's always a pleasure. What is your favorite comfort food, and do you still like cooking for yourself?
I still love cooking. As I said, you know, my mother, 98, she lives with me, and I cook all the time for her, and then I cook, you know, I put it away, big pot of chicken soups or whatever, then I pull it out. We ate together before I came down. So I love cooking. On the weekend, the kids come and everybody, and they was cooking, and I love cooking. My comfort food, I guess I would say, is pasta. I love pasta. And it doesn't have to be complicated. Garlic and oil is fine. You know, a little anchovies in there is good too.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever.
Hi, Lydia.
Hi.
Love all your shows. I've been watching them for years. Trying to pick up anything I could. My question is, your shows, I've noticed, I watch a lot of cooking shows. Your show's known for a lot of more easy-to-find ingredients, I guess. Have you ever, when you're planning out, like, to make something on the show, have you ever encountered something where, like, an ingredient where you're thinking, I don't know if, most people in, like, you know, rural America are going to be able to find this?
All the time, when I do a recipe and I use it on television or in my books, I always think about, you know, what is the good of me choosing or using our ingredients that nobody's going to be able to, and they won't cook this recipe. So sometimes I do use it because I think the American public is really interested in food and wants to learn ever more. And then I go and describe and explain that product, you know, how it's made, how it's used in Italy. But along the way, I always give an option of a substitution. So if you don't have, let's say they say you have I'll tell you to use aged balsamic vinegar. Now you have it and whatever. But, you know, if you don't have aged balsamic vinegar, if you do a reduction of a good vinegar, even with some wine in there, you get closer. So I would tell you a substitution. And I'm very, very conscious of the recipes being accessible, being doable, because otherwise I am not relevant. You know, if I can just show you what I can do, so what? You know, I want to come in your homes. I want you to smell like Lydia's home smell. I want to lead you to a place where I am very comfortable and I love. And I know that, you know, that's a good place for people. Food on the table, good, honest food cooked with love and given from the heart is positive, always positive.
Welcome to Philadelphia. I just had a two-part question.
Sure.
What is your favorite region of Italy to eat in? And have you ever dined at Osteria Francescana?
Oh, okay, let's start with Francesca Massimo Bottura, my friend. And he's considered one of the best restaurants. But he is one of these new chefs, if you will. Although he bases some of his things in tradition, it's about him. You see, I think that there's different roles of chefs. And there are chefs that it's about them, their inventiveness, their character, their style, you know, just like a painter or whatever. And there are chefs like me that are conduits, conduits of a culture. It's not about, that doesn't mean that I don't approach a recipe, that I don't maybe change it a little bit or whatever. But I don't claim to have invented any of the recipes that I do. They belong to a culture, you know, and so I work at it. So if you go to Francescana, you're gonna eat deconstructed pasta e fagioli. You know, I mean, it depends how he's gonna deconstruct it. But he's a wonderful and very talented chef. He is. He's a dear friend and very, and he comes from the region of Emilia Romagna, where the grana padano, the parmigiano, the balsamico all comes. It's a culture very rich in food, you know, rich food, tortellini, brodo, all of that good stuff. And he's a great guy. So if you travel around Italy and if you want to try the innovative chefs of Italy, he would be one of them. Italy has 20 regions. And so which regions do I love? I love them all in a way, and I think that it's best climate makes each region shine. The time of the year makes each region shine differently, because the climate in Italy is very diversified between the Alps to the north and the Apennines going down the south. So there's a lot of microclimates, ocean all around. So, you know, the oceans, the waters really make a difference in temperature. South in Sicily, you know, the different also occupation, but Sicily is almost on the coast across from Morocco, so very resembles that cuisine. So midsummer, love Sicily, the eggplants, the tomatoes. In the fall, I love Piemonte, the truffles and the wines and all of that, and so on. The region that I come from, we do a lot of, it's good winter cuisine because we're at the hill, at the foot of the Alps down there. But I love springtime because it's a foraging cuisine. So I love going foraging and then making the risottos, the soups, all of wild foraged greens. So each region has its optimal, I would say, time of the year that it really shines. Italy is beautiful all over. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, Lydia, grazie mille.
Prego, prego. And I just went, she took me to the kitchen, and I was astounded at the beautiful kitchen and what you do there.
Thank you.
Yeah?
Yes.
Share a little bit.
Oh, well, thank you. We have the first commercial-grade kitchen classroom in a library in the country. It's right here in this building on the fourth floor. And what we do is culinary literacy, and that is teaching people about cooking and through cooking.
It's communicate with food. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.